the members of the steering committee, and the state chairman of the Midwest region. It has been both an honor and a pleasure working with the gentlemen of Washington and Lee University this past year. Today, I come before you with the singular honor of introducing Senator William Proxmire of Wisconsin, our keynote speaker. Senator Proxmire earned his undergraduate degree from Yale University in 1938 and a master's degree in business administration cum laude from the Harvard Graduate School of Business in 1940, as well as a master's degree from Harvard in public administration. First elected to the United States Senate in a special election in 1957, Senator Proxmire was re-elected in 1964, 1970, 1976, and 1982. Thus, he has served in the United States Senate for the past 28 years. Long known for his independent thinking and clear vision in the Senate, Senator Proxmire is presently the ranking minority member of the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee. Senator Proxmire is also a member of the Appropriations Committee and the Congressional Joint Economic Committee. In his one-man fight to stamp out wasteful government spending, his monthly Golden Fleece Awards have illuminated and on several occasions helped to eradicate the egregious squandering of taxpayers' money. A man of principle, Senator Proxmire accepted no campaign contributions in his last two re-election contests. In fact, he spent a grand total of $177.73 in 1976 and $145.10 in 1982. Senator Proxmire. Senator Proxmire is a dedicated public servant in the truest sense of the word. Since 1966, the Senate has held over 8,000 roll call votes. The average senator has missed over 800 of these votes. Senator Proxmire has not missed a single vote. This is the longest unbroken record in answering Senate roll call votes in the history of that august body. Ladies and gentlemen, it is with great pride and pleasure that I present our keynote speaker to the 1984 Washington and Lee University's mock Democratic convention, the senior senator from Wisconsin, the Honorable William Proxmire.
Terrific. Thank you very much. Thanks a lot. President Wilson, Teresa Keough, Chairman Likes, Co-Chairman Lewis and Mueller, Teresa, I can't tell you how much I appreciate that very fine introduction. You know, out in Wisconsin, unfortunately, some of my constituents say we'd have a better country if I'd missed all those votes. Now, you've had Charlie McDowell, Senator Fritz Holland, Senator Joe Biden, Senator Jennings Randolph. Now you have me. So I feel like a star movie actress's fifth husband on their wedding night. I know what I'm supposed to do, but I'm not sure I can make it interesting. But I do want to congratulate the country's greatest mock convention on your amazing success in coming up with the winning nominee. And believe me, it's a great honor to have an opportunity to speak here in Virginia. Virginia, as you know, it honors our country with George Washington, the father of our country, a great Virginian, James Madison, the father of the Constitution, a great Virginian, Patrick Henry, the father of our most imperishable motto, "Give me liberty or give me death," a great Virginian, Robert E. Lee, the father of the Confederacy, president of Washington and Lee University, and history's noblest champion of a lost cause, Thomas Jefferson, father of the Declaration of Independence, father of the Bill of Rights, father of the Democratic Party. And you know, John F. Kennedy gave a toast in the White House at a dinner which he had for the elite of this country back in 1962 or so. And he had the leading scientists, the leading poets, the leading authors, leading business executives. He said, "Never before in this room has so much talent been gathered together in one place since Thomas Jefferson dined here alone." And now you were honored by having your fine governor, Charles Robb, the first Democratic governor of Virginia in much too long, address this body, and an excellent governor under extremely difficult circumstances, doing a superlative job and a fiscally responsible job. Then you have Congressman Jim Olin, the first Democratic congressman from this district in much too long. Compassionate, he's the author of the Virginia Wilderness Bill, which was just passed in the Congress this week, a business expert, and just what this country needs in the Congress of the United States. He's also incidentally introduced a bill to repeal the congressional pay increase. I've had a chance to read your platform. I mean the Washington and Lee mock convention Democratic platform. It's a good platform. It says in part, "This party will take no action whose effect will be a significant increase in unemployment. No fiscal action, no monetary action, no budgetary action." Well, good for you. You want jobs, jobs for the American people. And I can tell you, by having talked with people all over my state and all over the United States, that that's what people want. They don't want a subsidy, they don't want a handout, don't want welfare, they want jobs. They want a program that will get them jobs. Now, having said that, and recognizing this is a Democratic convention, how about the challenge the Republicans make? They say, "Well, look at the record. The jobs are up," they say, "taxes are down, profits are up, inflation is down. How about it? What's wrong with the situation?" Well, as one Democrat, I feel like H.L. Mencken's definition of a cynic, as the kind of a fella who, when he smells flowers, looks around for a casket. In this case, sure, unemployment is down and jobs are up. But we've been through a terrible recession. Unemployment is still close to 9 million people, which is much too high. Furthermore, there's been no improvement in unemployment for 3 months. Unemployment's been at the same level in February, in March, in April. Why no improvement? Because interest rates are beginning to rise. They're beginning to slow down home building, beginning to slow down automobile sales. Now, the reason that they are rising, as I'm going to point out, is because of the colossal federal deficits. And those federal deficits are appalling. President Reagan, in his inaugural address on January 20th, 1981, almost 3.5 years ago, said the following, and I quote, "For decades, we have piled deficit upon deficit." This is President Reagan speaking. "Mortgaging our future and our children's future. To continue is to guarantee social, cultural, political, and economic upheaval." And then President Reagan said this, "We must act today in order to preserve tomorrow. And let there be no misunderstanding, we are going to begin to act today." He said, "We are going to begin to act today." That was January 20th, 1981. Well, President Reagan, that was 1,205 days ago. Has he acted on the deficit? He sure has. He sure has. He has indeed. He gave us not a wimpy, panty waste of a deficit. What chutzpah? He's given us a killer, diller, super all-time record breaker. Not of one deficit, but a series of deficits. Now let's put this in perspective. Put this in perspective. In 1976, the all-time record prior to 1982 was $66 billion. That was the biggest deficit we've had in the history of this country until the Reagan administration in 1982, $66 billion. It was big by, in 1981, we had a deficit that was big by historic standards. It was $58 billion. But then in 1982, the deficit really began to take off. And that year, the deficit went to $110 billion. And in 1983, a year of recovery, when the deficit should have dropped, the deficit went to $195 billion. Now, unfortunately, as they say in that old song, baby, you ain't seen nothing yet. Because that deficit is likely to go on and on and on for some time to come unless Congress finds some way to act. Now, some people will say, so what? So what? So what if we have the high deficit? That reminds me of the story of the ship that was moving along in the night on a very dark night. And all of a sudden, a light moved up ahead. It looked as if they were on a clash course with another ship. So the ship sent out a message, change course, 15 degrees south. And the message came back, you change course, 15 degrees north. So the captain of the ship said, let's tell him who I am. So the message went out, this is a captain speaking, change course, 15 degrees south. The message came back, I don't care who you are, change course, 15 degrees north. Then the captain said, let's tell him who we really are. So the message went out, change course, 15 degrees south, this is a battleship. The message came back, you change course, 15 degrees north, this is a lighthouse. Well, I tell that story because believe me, if we permit that deficit to continue, we are in very deep trouble in all kinds of ways. Let me quickly spell them out. Number one, it's bound to have an inflationary effect. There's no way the federal government can run deficits like this and spend so much money, so much more than it's bringing in, without having a very serious effect on inflation. And the interest-sensitive industries are really going to suffer. Home building, which provides a tremendous amount of jobs in this country. Home building is super sensitive to interest rates. Back in 1982, the mortgage rate hit a level of 17%. And at that level, with the average new home costing $70,000, then a young couple buying a home would have to pay $1,000 a month in payments on that house, of which 80%, $800, was interest. So what had happened is interest rates had risen so sharply that literally hundreds of thousands of families simply couldn't buy homes. In fact, we lost 1 million housing starts that year. Every housing start is 2 man-years of work. So we lost 2 million jobs in that one industry alone. Automobiles. 3/4 of the people who buy cars buy them on time. Not long ago, I had a chance to talk to the president of American Motors, who has substantial production facilities in Wisconsin. And I said, well, I suppose you're concerned about Japanese imports. He said, no, Senator. He said, we're concerned about interest rates. That's what's killing the automobile industry. Of course, the automobile industry has had a comeback as interest rates have fallen, but now they're beginning to rise again and they're going to be in trouble. And once again, you're going to have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of jobs, probably well over 1 million jobs, that will be lost because we aren't producing the cars that we should produce that are needed, but people can't afford because interest rates are going up. But then you have another series of industries that are even more seriously affected. And that's any industry that is in export or affected by imports. And that involves millions of jobs in this country. Between 1980 and 1982, when the deficits began to rise, we had an explosion, a bloating, in the value of the dollar. It rose very sharply. With respect to Japan, for instance, the dollar rose 21% in 2 years, from 1980 to 1982. Now, what did that mean? That meant that when we buy things from the Japanese, it cost 21% less. It was like a 21% price cut. When they bought from us, it cost 21% more. So what happened? We bought more Japanese cars, computers, television sets, radios, and so forth, because they had that price advantage. With Europe, it was even worse, because as compared to the lira and the pound and the mark and the franc, we had a 30% increase in the value of the dollar. There again, the price of everything we bought from Europe dropped. Everything they bought from us went up. So the balance of payments deteriorated. Last year, it was a $61 billion adverse balance of payments. And the Secretary of Commerce says that next year it will be over $100 billion. What does that mean? A $100 billion adverse balance of payments means that we lose 2.5 million jobs. For every $1 billion adverse balance of payments, the Secretary of Commerce has said that's 25,000 jobs we lose. So the cost is terrific. Now, there's something else that those of you who are students at Washington Lee University should be especially sensitive to. This deficit we're incurring now, these deficits will go on indefinitely. They may never be paid off, maybe not even in your long lifetime. So for 60 or 70 years, and you're going to live a long time with the miracles of modern medicine, for 60 or 70 years, you're going to be paying interest every year on this national debt that we're incurring now. When we're older, we don't worry about that. There was a little ditty in the Wall Street Journal the other day that said, the older I get, the less I fret about where they set the national debt. Well, at your age, it's something else, because you have a lot to fret about. Let me give you a really dull statement and then put some more exciting clothes on it. Here from Dullsville, the Treasury Department is now paying about 9.9% interest on three-month notes and slightly over 13% on 10-year bonds. These rates are between 1 and 2 percentage points higher than those assumed by the administration and the Senate Budget Committee for 1984 and 1985. Now wake up, because those higher interest rates will just about wipe out the savings from the much-touted deficit down payment the Rose Garden budget plan agreed on by President Reagan and the Republican leaders will be wiped out by the increased cost to the government of paying the interest that has just gone up in the last few months. Furthermore, the President of the United States, President Reagan, is about to ask the Congress to approve a bill to add $262 billion to the national debt limit. We'll reach that $262 billion additional debt in a little over a year. Now get this, paying interest, just interest, I'm not talking about paying the principal back, paying interest on that extra one-year increase will cost the taxpayer about $26 billion a year. Let me put that into perspective. The interest payments on that additional amount will cost more every year than the entire 1985 budget of the Interior Department, the Justice Department, the State Department, with the National Aeronautics and Space Administration and the Environmental Protection Administration thrown in. So do you see why Democrats want to bring down this colossal Reagan deficit? Now, what do we do about it? What do we do about it? Well, there's no easy way. I wish we could do it by just having golden fleeces that worked. But we can't do it that way, unfortunately. There's no easy way. We have to follow a tough, austere, puritanical path. Puritanical. Mencken defined puritanism as the haunting fear that somewhere, someone is happy. But this is what we have to do. We have to cut spending right across the board. We have to increase revenues and taxes. And I can tell you, as one who's been in politics for a long, long time and run for statewide office 9 times, there's nothing but nothing less popular than cutting popular spending programs except increasing taxes, and we have to do them both. Now let me say exactly where we ought to cut. And in some cases, I disagree with your platform, although I think it's a fine platform in some respects. You're calling for programs that I think we have to reduce. Let me say where. The MX missile. Now, the MX missile is going to cost at least $30 billion in 1984 dollars. And on the basis of all the experience I've had, and your fine professor, Clark Molyneux, can tell you in better detail than I can, that cost is going to be a whale of a lot more than the $30 billion they say now. But the reason the MX missile is wrong is not just the cost, or not even primarily the cost. It's because it is an unstable weapon system that is extraordinarily dangerous and could literally wipe out civilization. Let me tell you why. It is a land-based stationary missile. It is a missile that would have 10 warheads. It would be put in one place, and the Russians would know exactly where it was. It is a use-it-or-lose-it missile. By that, I mean that once the president got any kind of a warning, even though he didn't know whether the warning was accurate, If he got a warning that missiles were coming in to take out the MX, he would have no alternative unless he wanted to sacrifice and forget about the MX except to press that button. The president could be awakened at 3 o'clock some morning, sleepy-eyed, and told, missiles on its way, use the MX or else. Well, he'd have to make that terrible choice. It's a missile which has that liability, and it has a worse liability. Yesterday, in the New York Times, there was an article that pointed out that the General Accounting Office, which has been uncannily accurate, it's been accurate time and time again on these things, says that the MX missile, on the basis of what we know now, probably could not fulfill its mission, which is to knock out the Russian land-based missiles, because they've hardened their sights. On the basis of the best Air Force intelligence estimates, it couldn't do the job. The second weapon system we ought to take a long, hard look at and cancel is the B-1B, the bomber. Now, let me tell you why. The Russians have the most heavily defensed airspace in the world. Their radar is very, very widespread and very effective. The B-1B has a radar cross-section like the Washington Monument. Furthermore, we have on the drawing boards a stealth bomber that will be in production in 5 or 6 years. That can evade that radar. That makes sense. Now, we should go ahead with a stealth bomber because that can do the job. But the B-1B will be obsolete before we get it produced. And then we have something else that is very dear to the hearts of Virginians, because you produce a lot of them right here in Virginia, Norfolk. And I'm talking about the aircraft carriers. You can't see a movie about aircraft carriers, you know, a movie about the Navy without seeing the aircraft carrier in it. It's the glamour girl of the fleet. And it's a beautiful weapon system. It has some problems, however, and that is that it is very vulnerable. As you know, it's big. It's as long as 3 football fields, end to end. It travels at about 35 miles an hour. It flies at 1 altitude, sea level. As Senator Symington used to say, it's like hitting a bull in the butt with a bull fiddle. You can't miss it. Admiral Rickover testified in his swan song, a great naval officer and a tremendous procurement expert. I asked him how long our aircraft carriers would last in the event of a war with the Soviet Union. He said about 2 days, and that's about right. They are vulnerable, and they are enormously expensive, $3.5 billion for each carrier, $7.5 billion for the planes on the carrier, $2.5 billion for the ships to support it, $15 billion in steaming costs during its lifetime, $30 billion apiece. We're building 2. The Soviet Union may be building an aircraft carrier. We have 13. They have no real aircraft carriers, and no other country in the world is building them. The tank, the new M1 Abrams tank. Now, there's a little brother that was supposed to cost $700,000. It's already costing $3 million. It has some attractive features. It goes 45 miles an hour, fires on the run, low silhouette. But it also has some disadvantages. It breaks down every 40 miles, worse than my Vega. Furthermore, it gets one mile on 4 gallons of gasoline. So in any kind of a running battle, you'd have to have a convoy of gasoline trucks following it into battle. And then you have the fighter planes, the most expensive weapon system we have, very essential. We have to have them, but we have to really pay as much as we're paying for them. In World War II, a fighter plane cost about $150,000 to $200,000. You know what the top fighter planes cost now to this country? They cost $30 million. Just for one little fighter plane, $30 million. The vice president of North American Aviation, a defense contractor with great experience, has projected the cost of the fighter planes the way we're going. He says by the year 2054, the entire defense budget will buy one plane. It'll be a beauty, but only one plane. Well, ladies and gentlemen, in the long pull, there's no substitute for stopping a nuclear arms race. There's no substitute for the nuclear freeze. The nuclear freeze... will save us enormous treasure. In the next 6 years, we're going to spend $450 billion, almost $500 billion, in building up our nuclear deterrent even more than it is now. Soviet Union will do the same. From a relative standpoint, neither one will make any progress. It's to the great interest of both sides to get together and negotiate an end to the arms race. And in doing so, of course, there'd be great savings. Now, unfortunately, we can't stop there. I wish we could stop with just saying we'll save money in the military area. We can't. We're spending much too much money in Medicare today. I wish we weren't, but we are. Let me document that. First place, let me say that the delivery system of Medicare is a great achievement in this country. There is nothing more important than health. And this country has done a marvelous job of overcoming heart disease and cancer. Today, you have a 50-50 chance if you get cancer for the first time in history of living and surviving that cancer. And heart disease, we've overcome that to a very great extent, made marvelous progress. And of course, it's delivering what we've been able to research and develop that is important. And Medicare does that. However, Medicare's costs have gone from $3.7 billion in 1967 to $50 billion in 1982, and it'll be $110 billion by 1988 unless we find a way to slow it down. Hard to do, but we have to find a way to do it. We have to blow the whistle on this enormous, explosive cost. Revenue sharing. We give about $5 billion a year in revenue sharing to the counties and cities. I wish we could afford it. I'm sure they like it. After all, it's unaccountable money. They don't have to go to the taxpayer and say, look, we're spending your money on a golf course, or we're spending on a swimming pool, or we're spending it on this or that, because it's money that comes from the federal government. But we can't afford to do that. We have to cut that out. The mayors won't like it, but we have to do that. Housing. I've been on the Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee for 27 years. I've been chairman of that committee for 6 years. And I can tell you we're wasting billions of dollars in housing, and we have to cut that back too. Agriculture. Virginia is a great agricultural state, and believe me, so is Wisconsin. We have 25% of all the dairy farms in the country in Wisconsin. But at the same time, we're spending much too much on agricultural subsidies. We can and should, and we are beginning at long last to cut that back. If we do all those things, we can begin to save money in another way too, and that's interest on the national debt. If we can eliminate the deficit that we're going to have this year, if we could eliminate it, we would save each year after that $20 to $30 billion. Now let me just quickly touch on one other aspect of spending, and that is the waste and fraud and abuse that I try to hit in my Golden Fleece Awards. I've been doing this ever since March of 1975, and the reason I've been doing it is because I found that spending isn't something that the President of the United States, no matter how diligent or intelligent he is, can control, no matter which party he's in. It's not something a cabinet can control or a Congress. Spending is done by literally thousands and thousands and thousands of people in the federal government. They spend money as fast as they can. You have to have that if you're going to spend $900 billion a year, almost $1 trillion a year. So when these people who spend this money come to work in the morning, they'll spend maybe $25,000 before coffee. Then they'll spend $10,000 a little later, then $15,000 on something else, then in the afternoon maybe $100,000 on some other project, then $50,000 on something else. They do this day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. They lose all sensitivity to the importance of money. There's no way they'd spend money from a firm or a family that way. So I decided to give the Golden Fleece to the most outrageous examples of wasteful spending. I gave it, for example, to one agency that spent $26,000 to try to find out why prisoners want to escape from jail. And they asked prisoners, you know, they're honest fellas, they'll give you a straight answer. Just recently, I gave a Golden Fleece to Medicare, because they spent, believe it or not, $45 million to cut toenails, to cut people's toenails. And then I gave one that I think that the students here could have taken care of pretty well. This was to an agency that spent $103,000 to try to find out whether sunfish that drink tequila are more aggressive than sunfish that drink gin. Sunfish. Now, I think they could have gotten plenty of volunteers from Washington Lee University for that project. And we gave it to another agency that spent $20,000, this was the Army, for a pamphlet to tell troops how to play King of the Hill. How to play King of the Hill, you know, this little children's game. And then I gave it to the Senate, because the Senate decided they would build a third gym. Now, we have already had two gyms. And one gym is a beauty. It has a swimming pool, it has a weight room, it has tables for senators can get a rub down, and for most of us, we're beat up old guys, our idea of a workout is a rub down, that's about all we get. But they wanted to build a third gym. And the third gym, they wanted to spend $750,000 just to equip that third gym. So when I gave them the Golden Fleece, fortunately, they backed away from it. Incidentally, in two-thirds of the cases, when I give the Golden Fleece, the programs I cite are either completely eliminated or sharply cut back. You say the trouble with the administration on this economic program that they have is they remind me of Yogi Berra. You know, Yogi Berra is the manager of the New York Yankees. He used to be manager of the Mets. And old Yogi was asked one day, what's the most important part of baseball? He said, is it? Well, Yogi said, the answer is that baseball is about 90% mental, and the other half is physical. Well, that's about the way they unfortunately look at this budget. We have to increase revenues. Now I'm going to give you a little tough medicine. Last year, I voted for the Reagan tax cut, but I think we went too far. The last year of the tax cut, the last 10% was more than we can afford. We repeal that, permit the first 15% cut, but not the last 10%. You save $40 billion a year. Then we provided for indexing to hold the taxpayer harmless from inflation. Fine program, I voted for it, it passed the Senate overwhelmingly. But again, it's something we unfortunately can't afford. Repeal that, we save another $40 billion a year. Then there's several other areas we can save, including expensing intangible drilling costs for the oil industry, knocking out depletion entirely. If people have a 3-martini lunch or a 2-martini lunch, let the federal government pick up only half of the check, permit a deduction, I should say, for half the check, not the whole check. Now let me finally conclude by saying that while economy is important, there is one issue that is overwhelmingly important, the most important issue that faces this country today and faces both political parties. And that is how we are going to prevent a nuclear war, how we're going to do it. Now we have two choices. One is a choice that we followed primarily. We've had a little bit of arms control, but primarily deterrence. We've followed that policy now for the last 35 years. And it's worked in the sense that we haven't had a major, at least a war between the two superpowers during that period. And people say it will continue to work in the future because the one thing the other side understands is strength. And there are arguments to that. Furthermore, that we can't trust the Russians, the verification won't work. But this means reliance on the arms race. And it's like, unfortunately, it's like good old W.C. Fields. You know, W.C. Fields had a softness for intoxicating beverages. And he said, W.C. Fields said, I always keep a stimulant handy in case I see a snake, which I also keep handy. Well, I think we've been hypnotized by that old snake, and we better recognize that we live in a different kind of a world. We don't live in a conventional arms world. We live in a world in which once the nuclear arms race starts, that is it! We're through! That'll mean that this country that we love, this country that has its great freedoms, will perish. There'll be a few survivors wandering around. But believe me, if you think that they've lost freedom in other parts of the world, it'll be far, far worse if we have a nuclear war. Furthermore, half the country will be dead, and there'll be likely to be no end to it. The scientists now tell us that we'll have a nuclear winter, that the soot and smoke will be so great that it will shut out all the light, and that we'll be stumbling around in darkness for weeks, and for months we'll have cold that'll be 13 below zero Fahrenheit, even here in Virginia, in July and August. That'll mean plants will die, animals will die, and most people who survive the war will perish from starvation. So the one way we can really achieve an end to the arms race is by negotiating, tough as it is, negotiating with verification, which we will insist must be very strong and very tough, including not only satellite inspection, but follow-up, and a follow-up in which we have on-the-spot inspection whenever there's evidence of violation. Leslie Gelb, the outstanding military expert for the New York Times, has said that deterrence can't last because the arms race is moving on to such sophisticated and complex weapon systems that will be able to overcome the kind of deterrent that we would like to have. The defense just won't be able to do the job. It's accident prone. And above all, you have the proliferation. The way we're going, there isn't any question of the fact that within a few years, many nations will have it. Our military intelligence service flatly predicts that by the year 2000, 16 years from now, 31 nations will have nuclear arsenals, and that includes Iran. That includes Libya. When that happens, you can kiss the world goodbye, if it does happen, if we permit it to happen. We simply must stop proliferation. And so as I leave you this morning, let's keep in mind what a marvelous life we can live here. We have a health prospects that's never had it before. As I say, we have cancer on the run, heart disease on the run. People can live longer and healthier and happier and fuller lives than ever before. We have educational opportunities. This great institution is one example of it. But all over the world, all over the country, we have more and more people who are able to go to college and learn. We have computers so that we can begin to correlate and direct and focus the great explosion of knowledge that we have. We have marvels of technological progress in those computers and in robotics and in other ways, so life is going to be much fuller and happier than ever. We have the marvels of space exploration. We're just on the verge of an unimaginably fine and beautiful life if we'll only give it a chance. So let's not blow it. Thank you.